Hey, Brendan.
Hello, Alan.
How's it going?
It goes. It
Good.
goes well.
Good, good, good. Well, it's not the day we're normally recording. We're actually recording ahead of day or a day ahead of schedule just to mix things up. Are we going to post it a day ahead of schedule too?
Sure. Why keep the people waiting?
Right.
Give them what they want. Give them what they're asking for.
Yeah, and apparently they've been asking for guests because they're tired of hearing just us talk. So we have, and I have no fanfare or drum roll or anything, but our pal Chris Arkenberg, and it's funny because I'm gesturing off to the other side of the table as if you were there, but hello.
Hey there, how you guys doing?
Doing
Welcome,
well.
Chris.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on this ramshackle kind of operation.
Well, thanks for having me.
Sure. I've been excited to kind of have you on for a while. We've had to play some sickness dodging kind of in the meantime, but I think both Brendan and I independently came across your article that was in it was on the Fast Company website. Was it published in their magazine too? Do they even have a magazine anymore?
They do have a magazine. I was not published in their magazine. I was on their sub virtual imprint, fastco.exist. So coexist. It's and specifically brought on as a futurist for that piece.
Well, it
That's right up our podcast
Right,
alley.
we were laughing because just the blurb, like the above the fold stuff, it was like 3D printing, bio printing,
Drones.
right, drone built buildings, and we're like, wow, we love all of these things.
It was a a little a pointy grab bag of futury goodness.
Well, if your goal was to get on the podcast, you have succeeded beyond your wildest expectations.
Woohoo! That was truly my only real goal. I mean, I like to aim high, so thank you for bringing me on.
Sure. So, tell us a little bit about, yourself in the future. Go ahead.
Oh gosh, myself in the future. I just like to think a lot. I'm not sure yet if it's a curse or a blessing, but I do like to think a lot about a lot of things. And particularly, I like, I really groove on technology and the way people interact with technology and the kind of feedback loop we have with technology. We make things, and then those things sort of remake us, and then in response to that, we make new things and kind of co-evolve, and that stuff really fascinates me. I like the details, and I particularly like the large scale systems, the way things kind of cross over the boundaries, interact with each other, and bleed around the edges, and do funky, unexpected things. It's all kind of this, really exciting unfolding of the world that I'm just deeply fascinated with and have been for a long time. And so, it's funny because I'm not a huge history buff, although I value it deeply. But I'm keenly interested in sort of the inertia of these things. And basically, I just love science fiction. I think it's cool. And so I tend to think of the world in terms of science fiction and what sort of could be or what we really don't want to be. And that's my sort of orientation towards, I guess, what you might call futurism.
Were there any particular science fiction authors or franchises that really influenced you growing
For
up, or?
sure. I mean, I saw the first Star Wars movie in the theaters, so that's, I was probably like 8 or 9 at the time, and that sure, had a big effect on me. I got really into these, I don't know if you remember the old die-cast, like, Japanese robot toys that you used to be able to get as a kid, before the Transformer and GoBot eras. Really dug those things and the whole kind of Japanese robo anime futures. And then once I got into my teens, dabbled in fantasy, if you will, a little bit. You know, I might be a little ashamed to admit it, but eventually I got a hold of Burning Chrome, which was a William Gibson book, and dug into that, and then read Neuromancer, and that was probably 80, maybe 88, if I can really date myself. I read Neuromancer. I was probably 17, I think I was a junior in high school. And not sure how much of it I truly understood at the time, but it was, you know, supremely cool. And I particularly responded to what he's now kind of become famous for, which was evolving science fiction from these glittering, you know, shiny world-building narratives to just the grunginess of the street and the fact that the future kind of looks a lot like the present but has some oddities, you know, some funkiness and weird tech that starts to bleed into it. After that, I got into, I read Snow Crash, probably 94.
And Neal Stephenson, yep.
And that was another one that, like, you know, just kicked it all up to a whole nother level for me, where I was pretty, you know, thoroughly impressed by his rendering, and it was fun, and it was funny, and it was, you know, kind of built on Gibson's thing. I really dug the idea of the burb claves and people, you know, sort of walling themselves up against the growing chaos of modernity. I'm trying to think of other films in that era that really stuck with me. I mean, eventually there was Minority Report, which kind of stuck with me a lot. I was also really into Philip Dick and a lot of his work, particularly the way he explored psychological responses to the oddness and weirdness of a changing world. I thought mm-hmm. he did a really great job. And so that was, for me, it was always about the human perspective at the center of a sort of rapidly changing future present.
Yeah, I think Philip K. Dick's stuff translated into a lot of movies. I was surprised. I think at some point it was rattled off, like how many of his short stories and books had turned into movies, and it's a lot higher than I had even thought about. Like,
and those are varying degrees of success with those translations.
Hey, sure. Don't knock Total Recall, man.
Well, maybe the original one. I'm not so sure about the new one.
Oh, I won't go near it with a 10-foot clown pole.
Good call.
I actually, I really liked Scanner Darkly.
Oh yeah,
and I think that actually was nicer as a movie. I think it was especially the animation style that they did with it.
The rotoscoping, yeah, that yep. Linklater did, and you know, I think was it Woody Harrelson, I think, played one of the main
yeah characters. Woody Harrelson, Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah, I thought they did a great job. I was really happy with that adaption.
So connecting this back actually to a guest from a while ago, Kevin Ong, who we had actually I guess it was a few episodes ago now, he worked on the rotoscoping for that movie. So
wow.
So we should.
That's a cool gig.
We should connect you. He has so many stories of, like, spending just hours drawing over Winona Ryder's face.
Well, that's funny because I do, you know, music production, which is another timeline-based editing creativity, and you kind of end up polishing loops.
Sure.
A lot. Mm-hmm. You know, you have your little whatever 20 seconds that you're just meticulously buffering, and I can imagine the meta weirdness of doing a rotoscope loop of a Scanner Darkly, like kind of being caught in some weird Dickian, you know, Phil Dickian time loop through that process.
Yeah, I love, actually, just you mentioned you do music production. I remember, I think it was a week ago, you tweeted something like, I have too many hobbies for a full-time job or maybe even a part-time one.
Yeah, it's you know, it's the lives we lead kind of in the margins left by our work. And ideally we can, you know, hopefully get to a place where our work kind of blends with the thing we love to do, or the passions, or the hobbies, or, you know, it's a challenge. I definitely have way too many hobbies to really put up with a full-time job, but such is life.
Yeah, it pays the bills. It's okay. I liked the actually the I think the thing you put up for the or named after the building, the architecture.
Sathorn Unique.
I think that was my introduction to SoundCloud.
Oh, cool.
So that was neat. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, Sathorn was a great project. My current wife, we were not, I say current because we were not married at the time. In 2009, we went to Thailand. We were just dating at the time. You know, you go to these extremely foreign places and it's a total culture shock and you're kind of blown wide open and you just kind of soak it all up and see what sticks. And one of the things, when we first got there, we were, you know, left the hotel. It always takes a day or so to really feel like you can even leave the hotel and deal with it all. We got out on the boat across the Chao Phraya, which is the main river that comes through Bangkok. And, you know, the skyline there, there's this, like, giant structure, huge skyscraper that was clearly not finished. And it was really fascinating because it was almost like it pixelated and got bit crushed the higher it went up. Like they, you know, kind of, they built the whole skeleton and then started fleshing it out. And the higher they went, the less money they had. And eventually it just kind of, you know, there's like steel sticking out of the top. So it just struck me, and I was like, God, you'd never see something like that in America, at least not to that scale, a skyscraper that was just left abandoned. You know, somebody would finish that stuff or tear it down. It wouldn't just be left empty. And it really struck me at the time, and like a lot of that sort of travel, a lot of things strike you and you don't really understand it, and it takes a few months to kind of percolate up and be meaningful. And I mulled on this thing and ruminated on it and thought about it and then came to this place where I was like, realized I wanted to do a soundtrack for this structure. It was this bizarre, very science fiction-y, very like, you know, Asian sort of clash of futures. On the one hand, it was supposed to be this amazing thing and there was all this money in the 90s and everybody was building in Asia, everybody was investing. And then it all fell out. The bottom fell out in like 97. All the money left, and the sort of the one future of this, you know, big cornerstone of Asian growth and success got displaced by this other future of this abandoned skyscraper that probably had like squatters in it, and there was graffiti on it, and so I was really fascinated to explore that space. And at the same time, I was really interested in the idea of sound and architecture. Because when you do a lot of music production, you work with reverbs and delays and panning and stereo pots, and a lot of that is really an attempt to just create spaces, spatiality. Before they had these tools, before they had digital reverb, you would just go into a church and record because it's like this giant space, or you'd go into a stairwell and you know that's how you get your reverb. Mm-hmm. So there is very much a sense of place encoded within music and within music production. So I kind of did this project and did these five tracks that charted the experience or my experience of this structure. Part of it was just the physical structure itself. Part of it was these competing futures that kind of, you know, went in very different directions than it was intended. Part of it was the relationship with the city. They call it the ghost tower because they believe it's haunted. It's like a husk, you know, it's like a corpse that still walks the skyline of Bangkok. So it's got this really rich kind of tapestry of you know, sort of evocations that it drew out. And so I used that as kind of a backdrop to really explore these ideas and push it into sound. And I ended up creating a kind of hip-hop instrumental soundtrack for this abandoned skyscraper in Bangkok.
Wow.
Yeah, I like it. It's really cool. I think it. I think my favorite part about the story is just it really is that intersection of a technology push. Kind of, we're gonna go this way, and this is how it's gonna be, and that's just not how it actually is. And that's I think the unintended consequences kinds of things is how a lot of maybe not a lot, but certainly a significant part of kind of the future ends up, right? Technology doesn't work exactly as we want it to, or it the way that kind of laws come around with things, it kind of remolds it in a way that is probably different than whoever was kind of originating that.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, we have these sort of ideals or these ideas that come into our mind that we want to enact in the world, and once you put them out in the world, they often take on very different forms or are beaten down. It's ultimately a competitive, adaptive environment that we're playing in, and if things don't cut it or if the environment suddenly shifts. Also, to your earlier note about it's sort of an inspirational science fiction. There's a bunch of Blade Runner samples that I blatantly ripped out of the Vangelis soundtrack and hacked into that. But that was another big kind of foundational bit of science fiction and narrative that really influenced me. And for some reason, it just felt like it worked in this context of the abandon Asian like superstructure.
Well, when I think Asian dystopia, I think Blade Runner.
So. Yeah. I mean, they captured it so well, and amazing they did it on a sound lot in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I think that is a really good one, because it's that weird like gap between the really cool tech and really where everybody else kind of lives. And that kind of thing. That do you think that there's enough kind of democratization of technology, or is that really is that really stratified?
You know, I think there. Well, so I hesitate because what I think is there are lots of different sort of streams. Maybe it is a strata. There's lots of different layers. So from our perspective in Silicon Valley, a lot of this stuff is being enclosed. It's there's not a lot of democratization in Google, Facebook, Apple. A lot of that's being closed. It's being camped on. It's being sort of drawn out of the commons and put into these walled gardens that you can opt in and you get certain affordances, but you can't reuse it a whole lot. But I think that we're also oversaturated with that perspective because of where we live, and we're all in tech and we pay attention to TechCrunch and all of that stuff. And that's, kind of probably the dominant of our feeds, our filters, our Twitter streams. We probably cultivate that type of sensibility. But I think there's like probably a lot more sort of garage, DIY, maker level sort of hacking and building and innovation all over the world. I mean, I'm sure there are like insane, weird clusters of biotech across the Indian subcontinent and, throughout East Asia and South America. And I think there's... whether it's intentional or not, I think now people have a lot more access to these tools and they have a lot more capacity to build them. Hardware is a great example. I mean, there's so much independent hardware, like tech hardware now, because it's so easy to manufacture this stuff and find some little outfit in China, to churn out your models that you built on your desktop in Inventor. And then have that stuff fabricated and sent back to you. And so I think actually it's highly democratized, but maybe not intentionally so by the sort of corporate powers that tend to run this stuff.
Oh, that's a really good way to look at it, right? I think you're right. The walled gardens of of Facebook, etc. They have that veneer of kind of everyone can use it, but the real stuff where the rubber meets the road kinds of things. I think that is a really interesting thing that now that those companies like Facebook and Twitter are almost purely kind of electronic, right? And then there's this sudden surge of everything, you can make, everything through like Etsy and anything 3D printed. It's just, it's kind of swinging into more, let's make stuff, let's build stuff, let's not just kind of think and talk about it.
Yeah, and it's this, and there is a struggle because a lot of the hardware manufacturers in particular want to lock down reuse. They don't want you opening the case. They don't want you modifying things. You void the warranty or whatever. But then there's this huge surge of people that are doing just that and taking things apart and putting them back together in different ways. And if you think of the like massive amounts of electronics waste that gets shipped to Africa and Southeast Asia, and then ends up in these massive landfills where you literally have ecosystems of people that are scavenging through that waste. And when they're not stripping out the essential minerals and bits of gold, they're reusing the parts and downstreaming them into all sorts of just funky little like ghetto innovation hubs, essentially, that are like trying to learn this stuff. Africa is a really fascinating sort of petri dish for this sort of thing, where they, give them these tools, and they've kind of leapfrogged a lot of the constraints of the industrialized world, and they're just kind of wide-eyed, and they start hacking around on, Arduinos or on mobile platforms, and suddenly they've, bootstrapped their community or their village up to, like, a whole new level of functionality. So it's really fascinating.
Yeah, I think it's really difficult to get the perspective, or at least for me, to get that perspective of what's happening outside the valley. It's such a, it really is a bubble. not only in terms of, what you have access to, but it's really just what you hear about or read about. It's just a very self-reinforcing kind of space.
As someone who lives outside the bubble currently, I mean, I still work in the bubble, but I'm interacting with people on a daily basis who are not in there. And there is a whole nother level of user activity that aren't doing things themselves, that are enjoying those walled gardens.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's we get so, I think, insulated in our little bubble and I don't necessarily want to call it tech elitism, but it is, in a sense. We forget about just like the average folks in our own country who aren't like, early adopters and fawning over Apple and tracking everything that Google does. I mean, we're a niche still. We may be a very productive and capitalized niche, but, I think as you say, Brennan, it's like a lot of people, that's why Facebook is so successful, right? It provides a great service for a lot of people. I personally despise it, but a lot of people, like, it works great for them, and that's a good thing.
So do you not have a Facebook account, or is it dormant? Is it?
It's funny, I actually... One of my last tweets welcome to the Hotel Cala Facebook. You can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave. Because you can't. So I have a Facebook account. I started it a while ago, kind of as an experiment. I was a late adopter. I held out for a long time. I Twitter works really great for me, and Facebook, I set up my account, I got into it, I used it for a while, I did the whole Facebook thing, and I found I was just getting into too many arguments with people about stupid little things, like with family members that I otherwise liked and knew we had differences, but, you find this sort of truce with your family where you're like, you just don't talk about certain things, and then suddenly Facebook, they're like, it kind of blurred all of that. So Yeah, 6 months or so, and then I bailed out. And just today, I checked back in because I got an email from somebody, and they were trying to get in touch with me. And I was like, oh, I should probably check my messages. And of course, Facebook had wide open welcoming arms, like, oh, it's been so long. Thanks for coming back to Facebook. We love you. And so,
we love your delicious data.
Oh yeah, give it to us. We'd be happy to use it to, you know, sell stuff to you and sell your data to other third parties so they can sell stuff to you. And yeah, but you know, all that aside, the whole advertising model for me, it was a weird blend of intimacy and non-intimacy. Like the way you can accidentally offend somebody in an email because emotion gets kind of stripped out from it.
Mm-hmm.
That was sort of the part of Facebook that doesn't really work for me.
Oh, but sure. Do you think that could possibly be more truthful communication with all the other stuff stripped out of it? It's like, these are the facts that I, you know, observe.
I could see that. Yeah, I think that's an angle. I don't have the stomach for it with my own sort of familial relations. And I get along well with most of my family, and I generally try to avoid confrontation. I think you're probably right that, like, you know, then my cousin is free to post on Jenny McCarthy or whatever, and that's cool, man, you know. it just didn't really work that great to me. I try not to condemn things that other people enjoy and that work, but I know what doesn't work for me and where I draw my own boundaries.
Well, I think an interesting thing for Facebook is that kind of it's asynchronous, but you kind of can like get everything at once, which I find really weird. Like with email, at least, you know, if you email me something, you know, 6 months ago, I have to go look 6 months ago, but it's much easier for that kind of stuff to bubble up and stick around on Facebook and kind of like hang around you. And I find that kind of aspect of it, feels weird. Like when you're talking to a person, when the moment's passed, the moment's passed. But with Facebook, it's like, well, 3 months ago, you said blah, 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 blah. And that, and the kind of permanence of your thoughts through Facebook actually inhibits me from interacting with social media in general in any kind of negative way. I don't want anything I say on the internet to be career limiting, is what it turns out to be.
That's a smart strategy.
Well, it's funny because I've gone back and forth on this. I don't post pictures of myself generally or of my wife or my family. Like, I don't give out any specific details about my life typically unless they're so mundane as to be non-specific. But it's interesting the way this sort of aspect of ourselves, like in a sense where you're creating a copy of your identity online through these different social media platforms, different forums, you know, the paths we leave across the web. These are, in a sense, sort of, you know, pictures of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And when you reflect on who you are as a person, it starts to include your interactions through these virtual spaces. It starts to include this history of all of the things you've said and the pictures you've posted and the life you've lived that you've shared through this virtual world. And there's something in there that's really interesting to me and a little scary and a sort of who knows what it's doing to us or how it might be reused, that our sense of self has grown into this digital space and that we have pieces of ourselves and that maybe that expands who we are, but maybe it also fragments who we are, that we have like these different shards of being, in a sense, you know, in these different social networks. And like you say, Alan, you know, the permanent record, this will all go down on your permanent record. And it's like, you know, it's there in a lot of ways. And people are supposed to evolve, but data is typically static. So, you know, you're supposed to be forgiven for what you did in high school or whatever. There's time and place for everything. It's in college, you know, that sort of thing. And yet, if you look at just your data, that's kind of this fixed object. And somebody could go back 6 years, 10 years, 15 years. Think of kids who, like, are digital natives who grew up and, like, record their entire, you know, all their youthful indiscretions are, like, on Facebook. And, like, what does that mean for them when they enter the job space or they're, you know, trying to be serious adults? Or there's something funky there, I think.
Or do you think possibly that the prolonged adolescence that seems to happen, that might change with the combination of the prolonged adolescence with this open personality of your social profile on, you know, social networks? Could that change what the real grown-up adult world is?
I mean, it seems like it will, right? It's like, because our, you know, consciousness evolves too, and the way we think about ourselves and the world is probably quite different than the way somebody in the 1700s did, or somebody at in the Egyptian dynasty, for example. Like, consciousness evolves as well with our tools and with the complexity of our society and the way we interrelate. And so I can only assume that, you know, kids these days, growing up attached to screens, it's almost a cliche now of the kids and their thumbs and their heads down staring into the devices. And, you know, we do this too, but maybe not to the same amount. But it's all kind of new for us. It's for them. It's just the way the world is. And you have to think that that's going to create a different type of psyche, a different type of social animal, in a sense, as they grow up and as successive generations emerge into this highly virtualized, highly distributed, and potentially kind of fragmented reality. So yeah, I think that it must. They must be different than us, right?
Yeah, and I love how fast that is, right? How fast that changes. It really is, has been, I guess it is about a decade for the iPhone, but I mean, just the thought that, you know, that your smartphone is probably used as a phone less than, you know, 10% of the time, if that, that has shaken up a lot of probably business models too, right? I mean, AT&T and those kinds of guys are not building voice networks anymore. That's completely data networks. Now all of the build-out stuff is like, you know, 5G is coming in Korea now. Samsung just announced it. So,
I mean, look at the newspaper industry or the cable industry or the music industry. I mean, it's emulsifying these content industries because now you've got it all in your hand. You can pull it from anywhere. You don't need these giant gatekeepers that, you know, there's still a place for Rihanna. And $1 million to build a song for her and build a market for her, but at the same time, it's like the massive long tail of, you know, I get my news from Twitter. Like, I have no need for a newspaper. Like you say, the in 99, I had a pager. That was, 14 years ago?
Yeah.
You know, it's not that long, and yet things have, like, pretty radically changed. Like you say, it's moving just quickly. Or maybe we're just through, you know, we're moving through a radical shift, and it's the shift itself is really fast. And maybe it'll settle down and not be so fast after a point. But yeah, this transition has seemed fairly monumental.
Yeah, if you want slow and not a lot of progress, but still kind of cool tech, batteries haven't gotten that much better.
no, they haven't. They keep trying. I think power usage has gotten better, so the devices are better at being more efficient for using what they can get in the battery. And the batteries can hold power longer generally. But it's amazing. I mean, kind of maybe to tie back into the FASCO piece, like when you look at the pace of robotics, and the miniaturization of computation. So the batteries might not have gotten that much better in the last 10 years, but like you can fit a massive amount of computation and sensing and networking on like a tiny little thimble, and stick it on a robotic dragonfly that you can, write some simple rules in and let it swarm around with its buddies. I mean, we're essentially there.
And we'll be happy when we're fighting those robots that we didn't create better batteries.
I for one welcome our insectile drone swarming overlords.
Oh, that's great. So normally on the show we have a few topics back and forth from the news that we kind of fire back and forth. One that I thought was interesting, and I think this is a real good example of futurism. Is it okay or not? And it's about, did you see the article about I think it was in the New York Times, about some scientists who are growing beef, like test tube beef, and there's going to be like a cook-off between like a few different scientists, and the one in the article was like they were using cow stem cells and having it differentiate into muscle cells,
Yeah,
and then
fat meat. Yeah, I've been following that stuff, and there's the one I just saw today, and didn't get into the details of it, but it was some restaurant, I think in London, maybe it was gonna like serve a vat burger, and it's what I saw. And mind you, this is I didn't go too in depth into this; it was just more of headline scanning. But it was something like $300,000 to be the guy who gets to eat the vat burger.
Actually, I think it might be the same source, because that was the number I saw too, and that
Well,
was
because that was the
because
cost to produce
right,
it.
because they're essentially making it, by layers of cells, just again and again and again, depositing one more layer of cells, one more layer of cells, and having them kind of take, and just the process alone sounded, prohibitively expensive. the one that it was compared to was one that was bioprinted beef, I think. And I'm actually not familiar enough with what that entails. But it supposedly meant thicker tissues, kind of out of the machine, as it were. So it might be more cost effective that way. I mean, it obviously comes down to what it tastes like.
Well, it depends on who you are, right? So, I think it's worth comparing this to another recent news item, which there was a UN report, in all seriousness, about the value of, humanity really reconsidering its relationship to insects as a food source. That
Yeah, I saw that.
there's a lot of them. And they're pasty and crunchy, and
They
you
got
can
the protein and fiber you need.
total flash fry them, in oil. And so, there's this notion that, on the one hand, there's this very expensive embryonic, no pun intended, or maybe pun intended, technology to like, design and print and vat grow, like essentially culture meat. That ideally would scale at some point where you can just like, cows are free to enjoy life to their old sweet days, never to fear the butcher again, and everybody gets to feast on these vat meats. But like you say, does it taste good enough? Well, maybe not for those of us who are used to a fat burger or whatever, but maybe enough for, say, a lot of the the Chinese population that is rapidly moving into the urbanized world and is suddenly demanding more meat.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a path of development for countries that we're spoiled with all the meat that we get to eat. Most countries don't eat much meat. Meat is like a rarity. It's very expensive. And so as countries develop and get richer, they want more and more meat, because that's what you do when you're rich. You eat other things, other animals that aren't as rich as you. But then on the flip side, there's like the insects. And, all those starving Africans or the population crunch and the urban mass of the Chinese mega cities, these locusts are swarming a lot. So you just like hold up a net and there's dinner.
Yeah, I think that really is where for me, like what would be a really interesting intersection of people and technology, right? That's more interesting to me because it's a more kind of realistic and foundational kind of thing. I mean, food is you need food to live. I don't necessarily need, NFC on my, iPhone 5 or whatever it's going to be when that comes out finally. So I can pay for my vat grown beef without taking my wallet out,
Well, and you got to appreciate that those insects are probably grass-fed. So it's
grass-fed, corn-fed, whatever they're growing, those insects will be happy to devour it all naturally. But it is, the vat meat stuff is fascinating because just on the side of synthetic biology, this is, again, this trend. It's like just like the miniaturization of computation, we're getting better and better at manipulating matter, and we got really good at manipulating it for transistors and computers, and we're starting to get pretty good at manipulating it for biological stuffs as well, and being able to kind of design what starts to look like at least the components of life. And there may be a point in the somewhat near future when we're actually creating life sort of procedurally, and that'll be a whole weird ethically challenging frontier.
Yeah, I think I have a lot of hope for kind of for those kinds of things. I mean, I like kind of ethically funky kinds of interactions of things, or at least I've liked those stories in media. I'm not sure if I would actually like that directly, but that also leads into something else. It's like, how soon can we get a legislature that can deal with technology?
Wow.
Never.
No. So, yeah, that's a tough one. Was it when Mars Attacks? When they come in and like basically phase the entire legislature into ashes?
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we certainly don't have... a lot of the debate, the public debate at the levels of Congress has been captured by a whole lot of... emotional wedge issues designed to rally tribes around different voting blocks. So, and I don't see the scientific tribe being particularly motivated to deal with those types of people.
Well, I think as long as science does still happen, I think we're going to be okay. I was really excited.
That's the worry, is it's not.
I think the thing that I saw most shared in the last like 48 hours was the Commander Hadfield video of Space Oddity. I mean, I think they should just play that constantly while the next time NASA tries to get any kind of funding.
Well, I mean, I think that's a really a great example, and maybe tugs at what what Brandon was saying, you know, that there's this sort of idea that that's going to bring the funding back to NASA.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think it's great. I think everything that he's done has been excellent for the space program. But the reality is that, like, the money for those things and the real innovation is coming increasingly from the private sector, from individuals, from philanthropy, and from business. You know, and I'm at a weird point in my life where I tend to defend government against business, which, you know, I was a punk and a raver and a deadhead, and the last thing I ever wanted to be doing was defending government. But I don't like that it's being taken over by an entity that has a profit motive rather than a motive to serve the people.
Yep.
But I think that, you know, maybe it's an old way to think to assume that we have to rely on the government to solve these things for us for much longer, or that science is going to die if the Tea Party takes over. You know, I think a lot of that stuff is just kind of shrugging away from governments. I think the state all over the world is in some ways in a bit of decline, or at least it's got a lot of competition.
Okay, we've covered so much ground, and I love it. I love it. We're coming up to about 50 minutes. I don't know. I'm unsure of where to take it, but I'm wondering, do you have anything that you want to specifically promote, or is there anything that you're working on that you know, we would, you know, go crazy over? That I know I would love to hear about almost anything. So, you know, I.
You know, it's interesting. I have, like I said, I have way too many hobbies. I have all sorts of projects. I'm actually at a point right now where I'm kind of trying to take a break and trim the fat a little bit. Music is always something I love. That's my real passion. I definitely ramble on and on about a lot of this stuff. It's mainly just because I pay attention, I watch things, and I'm legitimately just fascinated by the way it all unfolds. I mean, I was raised Catholic, haven't been to the church in ages, and, you know, pretty much rejected it in large order. But I feel like I'm not an atheist. I see what might be described as God in the world around us. It's just amazing to me. There's a lot of crap and a lot of horror, but it's all just incredible, the way it's all unfolding and rolling forward. And so the stuff that's really fascinating the most to me is how we're really just animals marching through this world, and that we're ultimately embedded in nature. We're embedded in ecosystems. And I am trying to see how nature speaks through us, and how the stickiest of our innovations reflect the need for the species to adapt, and ultimately the needs of the planet to be a functional, sustainable organism of itself. And so that's the stuff that I'm trying to kind of come more into alignment with and understand in my own sort of projects. And that's the stuff that really fascinates me. It's funny, because I get really into dystopias, but I'm actually a deeply optimistic person, and I'm not exactly sure how those two line up, but I think maybe there's something in understanding the dystopias as actually drivers towards, not utopias, but towards good solutions.
Sure.
Oh, you know, yeah. It's like humans aren't very proactive. We're extremely reactive. Mm-hmm. We're incredibly adaptive, and so the climate has to tank visibly for us to then suddenly mobilize the gears of industry to actually change things. You know, and so that there's something there that the value of dystopias, the value of the messy futures in guiding us towards better futures. You know, futurism is an activist pursuit. It's really saying, like, hey, here's something shiny and cool that we should work towards, and here's something ugly and dangerous that we should work away from. the futures try to reflect that back at us, and so that we try to, you know, do the right thing in the present to hope that the future will be a pleasant place for us. So I don't know. That's not really promoting anything so much as a philosophy, I guess.
Philosophies are important.
They
are a thing.
Thank you, Brennan. You know, in another world, I'd just be a state philosopher. You know, they used to pay people to just sit around and bullshit like this. And I think they still do. It's just that you have to work for TechCrunch or be Michael Arrington or something.
You got to get some sponsors for your podcast.
It's like, yeah, sponsors. Shout out to Autodesk and Goldman Sachs. Yeah, they've got a lot of money. Yeah, I guess the only thing I would really promote, I'm going to have a couple more things on Fastco, but really, music. I'm going to have an EP out, and that's the stuff I really love and the stuff that I really have the most sort of passion towards and the thing that I really want to share the most. I can ramble and rant about this stuff till the cows are liberated by the vat meats and the streets of Rome under halcyon verdant plains and you know, buzzing drone insects. But music is really the thing for me.
Rad. Yeah, I'm really glad that we had you on, Chris. Thank you for taking some time to gab with us for a bit.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you both. Thanks for having me, and thanks for letting me rant, because I can sure rant when people ask me questions. I can rant a lot. I can be really quiet the rest of the time, but when people ask me questions, I will get my rant on.
Awesome.
Well, we're always looking for guests, so you know, you're welcome back anytime you feel like you need to get something off your chest or find some cool that you need to share with the world.
Great. I'll definitely love to come back again before too long.
Cool. Brendan, you have anything else to add? Otherwise, we'll crunch this out a day early, and I will talk to you next week.
Yeah. Till next time.
Thanks, you guys.